Hello and welcome to Diversity in Research. My name is Lachlan Smith.
And I'm Jakob Philfus-Christensen. Today we are talking to Eva Kaigiri from Scientia Scripta, a UK-based consultancy. We had a chat with Eva a while ago after we connected on LinkedIn and decided we had so many things in common and so many things to discuss that we actually wanted to do a podcast episode with her. So we managed to schedule that luckily, and we had a good discussion about how they work as a consultancy and her thoughts. You can hear more about her story, being from Kenya, moving to Finland and then to the UK later, and her experiences personally and in higher education. And then just as we were going to record this, they could tell that they had received a grant from Wellcome Trust on policy development from the Wellcome Trust Policy Lab. So we had a chat about that as well, and they have a really interesting approach to some of these topics that we are very keen on following and see what comes of that. But for now, let's just go to the interview, and then we'll be back with a follow-up afterwards. Hope you enjoy. And so we are joined by Eva. Eva, welcome to the podcast. Before we dive into today's topic, could you just perhaps tell us a bit about yourself and Scientia Scripta?
Yes, Jakob. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. Really excited about this and very happy to have connected with you on LinkedIn and seen your previous work. So my name's Eva Kagiri Kalanzi. I was born in Kenya and I grew up there, and then spent the other half of my life in Finland, and now spending, I think, maybe, I don't know if it's the other half or quarter of the other half in the UK. So I'm what you'll probably call maybe a global citizen in many ways, influenced and living across different cultures. So I'm the head of communities and partnerships at Scientia Scripta, which is a research communication agency, and generally what we do is that we focus around content production or translating research for the public, and at the same time we also do work around like impact evaluations or integrating impact into research and innovation, and also ethical engagement in research and innovation.
Cheers. And on the website you describe yourself as an ethical consultancy. And from our previous conversations, as you said, we connected on LinkedIn. I know that diversity and inclusion are topics close to your heart. Can you explain a bit how that informs your work, both in the company broadly, but also you personally?
Yeah, I think to respond to that question, I need to provide a bit of history about my own background and then how I came to join the company, because I think it gives better context. So my background actually was is in environmental engineering. And I remember on completing my bachelor's degree many years ago, which I'm not going to mention, so you can't calculate my age now. But when I did my bachelor's degree, I remember like in the fourth year of my degree, just thinking, okay, I have two options here. I could get a very good job, probably in a wastewater company, doing very interesting either research or involved in technology around wastewater treatment, or I could do something else. And at that point, I was feeling quite lost in a way that I'm very appreciative of what going to work, say, in a wastewater treatment factory, what that would mean. It would mean obviously that, okay, I'm helping to sort out problems on environmental sustainability. But the social impact for me was also starting to sound like a more important thing. And I wasn't very sure what I would need to do to be able to get into that path until I found out that I could do a master's in social sciences, specifically in international development. So at this point, you'll understand, like, I was still, and I'm still very much rooted with my Kenyan roots. And then I was in that situation, I was feeling that I recognize challenges that exist around environmental challenges in that context. And here I am with this knowledge, and I wanted something to connect these two things. So I decided to do a master's degree in social science, which was in international development. And that was a real eye-opener for me, because for the first time, I understood that it is possible for technology to be designed for the good of people. And from that point, I just took this path in my career where whatever science I'm engaged in, even when I went to work in higher education, I've always been very interested in the social impact of research and innovation. And that's how my journey started. So coming back to Scientia Scripta itself, so the company was started by a former colleague of mine who's now a friend and a colleague still. And we met when we were both working at a university here in Manchester. And I knew he had this company, and we used to talk about it quite a bit. And at that time, it was very focused on science communication. But we both realized that we were very interested to be involved on issues around impact. He was an impact manager for the science and engineering department at the university. And we started talking about, wouldn't it be possible actually to sort of repivot this company and expand it to include other things as well, because we were both interested in these two things. And that's how we got engaged, or how I then got involved in Scientia Scripta. So when we started thinking about this more extensively, we needed to think, what does that mean? What does impact mean for us as a company? What does it mean for our engagement in the research and innovation space? And that's how we came up with our mission statement, together with not just myself and Edwin, who started the company, but Holly, who's also one of the senior leaders in the company. And we came up with this mission statement that actually one of the challenges around how research is done and how research is perceived maybe in the public sphere is that it's sort of something that's very separate from people. Most of the public don't understand it. They don't understand what's the benefit of it necessarily, unless it's something concrete, like, okay, like with the COVID vaccinations, okay, this was something concrete that came out at the end of a process. And even with that, we saw, like, you know, there were people who were not for it somewhere. So we say that the space is so closed up. And how about if research was done differently? So we started saying that our mission was to democratize this process. So we challenge research organizations and R&D-led businesses to think about how they should and could open research more for the public. So this means that it's not just about pulling off public engagement events where you, which is not bad, but it's going deeper than that. It's about, you know, inclusivity. And what does that then inclusivity mean? And that's when we start to think about things like fairness, equality, justice, you know, who gets us to the table, and really thinking more about that space in that way.
But I think that's really, that's interesting, because it's, I think it's a good discussion we have regularly when we are talking both to research managers, but also researchers, and we talk about this about diversity, and we start talk about communication. And one of the things we almost end up saying at some point is, because they would say, but we always do research communication to the general public. It's like, there's no such thing as a general public. Because if you speak to a general public, you're also talking to a majority, and then you have a ton of minority groups, and they don't consider themselves included.
And if you look statistically, sorry to interrupt, if you look statistically at what kind of people tend to attend, say, like science engagement events, you're more likely to go to that kind of event if there is a member in your family who is science-oriented. So your parents might be a teacher, or your father's a professor, or could be the other way around as well. The father is the teacher and the mother is the professor. Anyway, but that's what happens. Like, you will need to have come from a nurturing environment that makes you aware, first of all, of the opportunity that there is that, and it's interesting, and even then gives you a reason to go to that kind of event. But say you are living in a marginalized community. And this marginalization, as we know, is can also be intersectional. So we start to go into intersectionality. So it could be that you say come from a very poor neighborhood and then say you are marginalized because of your orientation, sexual orientation, or then also about poverty, because this is also about class. And then what is the likelihood that first you will be aware of these opportunities? And then secondly, that you will even have that intrinsic value attribution to those kinds of things, or even to science, because first of all, you don't have role models in society who suit the way you, who, how you recognize or identify yourself. So you don't even feel that that is a space for you. And this, I think,
yeah, is, and it's also based on history, I think, and that's of course not science communications as such. But I remember with the COVID vaccine, I think it was the US, where they had some statistics on who got vaccinated, the fastest risk groups of society. And it turned out that the gay community had an extremely high rate of people getting vaccinated. And people are like, oh, but what's happening and why? Because it's a marginalized group, and et cetera, et cetera. Until someone told them, because the gay community has already seen what happens with the pandemic. For this pandemic, we know what happens if there is a vaccine. We're going to take it because we have seen what happens if there isn't one. So I think, and it's just such a, I think it's an interesting example of how sometimes also history as a group informs that sometimes you're actually more inclined to be interested in science, or a particular kind of science, or responds to it in a different way, as in because something happened as a group.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, Jacob, you bring that up about that period, because so I'm going to say this, and I now laugh at myself thinking about it, but in reality, when I think more about it, I'm like, okay. So I don't know if you remember, but at the beginning of that pandemic, when even the researchers themselves, they were not very sure how this virus is operating in terms of who's more likely to get to die, especially. You know, we all knew, like, okay, everyone's more likely to get infected, but who's more likely to die? And I remember at one point, there was something in the news that, oh, we've done this quick study and we think BAMEs are more likely to die from the virus.
Oh, we should perhaps just, for international listeners, we should perhaps just explain what that is.
Yes, definitely. So BAME is, or BAME, as it's called in the UK, is Black and Minority Ethnic. Yeah. So these are people of Black heritage or Asian heritage, and other minorities of color. So I just remember, like, thinking that I so fit that group. And I said, I became paranoid about even going to the shop.
Yeah.
Because of, like, I am more likely than anybody in this shop, because I live in an area which is, it's not necessarily like Caucasian dominated, but I just remember thinking, I'm a minority in this place and I am more likely to die. And I became completely paranoid about the whole thing. And then later it came out, like, the data was based on, or the study was based on, also on cultural, there were other cultural, like, context around it. So, like, for instance, in some households, in some, say, like, some certain communities, like, there is intergenerational living. Mm. So you might find that there's the nuclear family and then there's the extended family living. But I completely, like, sort of zoned out of that extra piece of information, even though I just live with my husband, myself, and my son. We could very well fit into a proper Caucasian household. Like,
exactly.
Like, in terms of our makeup. But I just remember thinking, all I saw was that I was more likely to die based on my ethnicity.
Could we just, I was interested in something you were saying earlier around the work you were doing with researchers and universities around effectively, I guess, the science communication side and getting them to engage and think about injustice, think about fairness, and those sorts of things. And I think, you know, the conversation we've had so far, I don't think Jacob and I would disagree with anything you've said, but how is it received by the academics? Like, Do they receive this with open arms and say, yes, come in and help us? Or do the universities, do you get pushback? Do people think, I'm not sure this is for me? How is it received? Because that's the bit that actually has to change. We can talk about what a great idea it is, but if nobody actually engages with it. So could you just share maybe some of the experiences that you've had?
Yeah. I think one of the best things that ever happened to this country, and I know there are some people who completely disagree and with good reason, is the introduction of impact into the research excellence framework. And at least parts of it when I think about it, because for the first time, I feel like what was initially something like research has always been measured at, against this, an excellence framework that's around the rigor of the research.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that has mostly been it. And then, of course, like the ranking in global ranking systems. But this introduction of this impact aspect challenged academics and research institutions to actually think about what does it mean to produce research that impacts society. And because of that, we have, in a way, gotten a leeway into having that conversation with research institutions and academics, because we go in through that angle.
Yeah.
They know now that there is that sort of requirement from funders to think beyond the rigor of their research into other issues as well. But it's not been easy, I must say that. And we found that some of the most difficult, like especially research, so what can I say, disciplines have been around science and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Social scientists have mastered this area. They have no problem. Social scientists anyway research about society. So they have no problem like opening up research spaces, but and also like thinking about equality, fairness and justice. But trying to make that case, say, for somebody who's designing a new technology that can reduce the cost of producing a metal sheet.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What does that have to do with me? You know?
Yeah.
And this is where we found most difficulty, like engaging with specific like disciplines. So we have sort of started to discuss it in a different way and saying that, for what reason do you do this research? So we sort of bounce back the question to academics. We're like, what is your motivation for this piece of work that you do? And obviously, if it's an engineer, they're like, okay, I just want to produce like a really good technology or something like that. But then we're like, but why? What is the legacy for it? Apart from being renowned in your area of, you know, expertise, what else? Don't you want like people to understand the importance of your work outside of experts in that area? And that sort of then makes them start to think of who they are, how they their positionality in society and their responsibility as academics to society. And those are difficult conversations to have. So I cannot.
No, I would imagine so, but easy, and I so think that, it's a bit, lying. I think it's interesting because it's some of the same challenges that we meet, particularly when we talk to researchers about gender analysis in research. Because again, you have to contextualize it in a slightly different way. Sometimes, you have to go back to and look at motivation. And sometimes you go into some research areas where it becomes very specific, and it becomes a very difficult conversation to have sometime. But it definitely resonates. You look like you were about to say something like that.
I'd be quite interested. Sorry, I'd be actually quite interested to learn some or to know of some very sort of successful examples of where anyone who's working in this area that we are all working in has been able to contextualize these issues for specific areas of research that are sort of seen as hard sciences. Because I think that's where we have lots of problems.
Yeah. No, I had a chat with some astronomers about it, and astronomy that was quite a lot of preparation in talk about gender analysis in their research, admittedly. But I think we got there, and it is this whole. And sometimes it's also we I think, and I think you would have the same thing. It's like, we don't have to solve it all right away. It's okay just to figure out where are the first steps. And here for us in that context, it was to say, to have the conversation, if some areas of astronomy was more male dominated than others, and there definitely were, and then say, well, let's start by looking into that. Start looking at why is it that people think that this specific area speaks more to men, to women, because it certainly doesn't. It's probably about tradition. And then use that to open the conversation about what is it in astronomy that makes these patterns, and use them to open the science to see where there is room for a gender analysis.
That's a good point. That's actually a really good example, because I started to think about the work we do on ethical engagement, which is very much in line with what Lachlan was saying about like the equality, fairness, and justice. So we are starting to, or it's one of the things we do, is that we help academics and R&D, like businesses, to think about their engagement activities. So we did some work recently with the Turing Institute. So for anybody who's not aware of this institute, it's proper hard science. Like, they fund hard sciences. And what we did with them is we helped them to, we trained, first of all, their public engagement staff members to think about how they run public engagement, like funding and things like that. And then we support them to develop their public engagement call for researchers. And during such processes, those are the kinds of points which we use to challenge such academics to think about what does engagement really need? Who is invited to this table? Like, how have you defined who this public is? Who's missing? Are you actually aware that there are people who are missing, that you might be attracting a very specific type of persons purely because of the messaging or how you have done your reach activities and things like that? So that is definitely something we are doing, and one of the ways in which we are challenging them towards this angle of equity, fairness.
Yeah, and based on that, I was just saying, because we, of course, wanted to talk about diversity more specifically in this, because, and you just touched on it here, because we have talked about social media and science communication here on the podcast before, and it's of course because it's important, but also because it's so complex, and you have touched here a bit on what the role of diversity is in science communication. And just try elaborate a little more, because some of the challenges we see in diversity are both about the researchers and the research, as you just mentioned here, and it adds complexity in a society that loves fast and easily digested news. And when you open conversations, like you said, about who's in the room, who are you talking to and for, et cetera, and then a lot of these things also becomes incredibly politicized, as you know, particularly when we talk about race and for us, LGBTQ plus issues. And I understand why some of the researchers just say, I'm not putting my hand in that wasp's nest. How do you help institutions navigate that?
Yeah. So we've always gone into these things thinking about selling the value. So we keep the politics completely out of it, yeah? And we come in from the point of there is value in doing this. And we try to show the value of doing this. And the value there's multiple layers of the value. So the value could be one that, okay, in the funder's eyes, it's good for you. That's a clear value for any research institution. If they think that something is going to attract more funding, they will do it, okay? But obviously, what we don't want is that this to be a the only driving factor, because what we are actually trying to do is system change, isn't it? Even what you're doing, both of you, is system change. And that's more complex because you're asking like huge organizations to change their culture of operation. And for them to do that, and even for the academics themselves to change their how they operate, there has to be a supportive environment. So the change is not just about the researchers, it also has to be supported by the institution at which they are. Okay, now there's funding recently in the UK that's been released around research culture. And that's also one that we can discuss another time, because different people are interpreting this differently. But then there is also like funding that's been released around like RNI, which is responsible research as well. So there's these conversations happening. And of course, we know that conversations around equality, diversity and inclusion are very big sort of in UK institutions. But we need to show the value of this diversity beyond, it should be like not a push issue, but a pull thing. Like they need to want to do it, and they need to see why they want to do it. So how we do it is that we talk to research institutions and academics, that when you open that space to more diverse audiences, you also get diverse input that feeds, even like creates better impact for your research. So you're not drawing from a very small group of people. You're drawing from a large group of people who bring like real and true ideas that are actually reflective of the entire society. Because what you're doing now by closing that space is that you're representing a very small number of society, really. And then you are using that to develop, you know, like research, which is then to impact the whole of society. So by doing that, you're driving injustice and inequality. But by opening that space, you start to represent entire societies, and you start to create change in a culture that has traditionally been very unfair to certain groups of people. And we try not to, at least I haven't seen a situation where we've turned it into a debate about who has more rights or what. It's more about that, do you believe, because inherently everyone, whether they, unless you're like totally racist, most people like agree that we are the same and we all have the rights to the same things. Like, that's a basic principle, isn't it? But then, okay, there are some people who are just like, no, we are not the same. They dehumanize other people. But in most cases, like when you are, if you were to just do an anonymous survey, most people just think that we are all the same and we deserve the same. But then it's just how then these conversations start to take place. And people sometimes are resistant to change because of power. So they think that by opening up this space to like a diversity or doing something, they're shifting power, and that they're giving up something, and they're not giving up something. They still have that power. They're just sharing it with a wider, a wider group.
We actually just had that conversation yesterday and in another context about the moment you talk about diversity, and particularly in the context of research funding, is always, there will always be a discussion of power. Because you will be moving power around, but as we talked about in that context, it was also, and if that scares you, you should just remember that if you do nothing, you're supporting the power structures of the moment. And it's not and the injustice in that. But I like how you how you address the power issues so directly. So they are there. But yeah, again, giving something up isn't to say you're not giving something up. You're just making the cake a bit bigger.
Exactly.
We're aware that you're just changing tack slightly. You've been awarded a grant from the Wellcome Trust to run a pilot on creative policy development.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in that project, you're using, let me get it right, collective mosaic making to visualize and explore complex policy issues, which sounds absolutely fascinating and completely different to anything that I've heard of before. Could you tell us a bit more about the project and why you chose that approach, and perhaps a little bit about, you know, whether how ethics and diversity concerns sort of play out in a project like that?
Yes, definitely. So this project, I'm very excited about it because thinking about how it was ideated and how it's come live. So this project started with first Edwin. So Edwin's the director of Scientia Scripta. He had this idea of this mosaic making as a way to engage the public in science engagement. So it started with that. It was purely around science engagement. So the idea he had was like, oh, it should be quite interesting to use like tactile methods to engage the public in this way. And he tested it a bit. I think he tested it first in 2022. He went to one of these, it was a science festival, I don't remember which one. And he just went beach combing, took a couple of these like different glass, ceramics, different things from the beach and stone. And what he did was that during that science festival, like people would just come up to our table and they'll just be asked like some sort of guiding questions like, where do you feel that you fit in research? And then people could pick whatever mosaic they wanted and then they place it where they want on the board. And then he would ask them, you know, why did you pick that specific piece? Because what happened is that clearly when you started to ask people, these things represented something to them. So like somebody would pick up like a piece that looks a certain way because they felt it represented maybe how they feel that it's a science is something that's too far from me. I don't understand it. And then they'll say, oh, I chose this color or I chose this feeling, which was something new, because they'll also touch this like ceramics and say, I like this, the feeling resonated this and this with me. So it was actually a combination of art, like bringing in art as a way to engage, and also then using this like tactile approach to get people to think about what those things symbolism, what those things represent. Anyway, so last year I see this call from Wellcome and I tell Edwin, this call is the one we should sort of apply to develop this collective mosaic idea. And he's like, oh, I don't know, you've never done it for policy. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. It's about breaking down the barriers of engagement, you know? So anyway, we applied for the call. Surprisingly, we were successful. Very impressed with that application, Edwin. Good for you. Anyway, so the whole thing, the main thing why, in relation to engagement and equality and the question that Lachlan asked, the one thing about this particular method is that everybody starts from an equal footing in that scenario. So what happens, I don't know if you have done a bit of work around policy engagement and around how the policy developing processes happen. So technically what normally happens in policy making is that it's very traditional in many ways. You get a group of people, maybe representing specific organizational stakeholder groups, come around a table, set up like a board meeting, and you start asking them, so what do you think about this idea? Traditionally, that's how policymaking has been. But you can imagine, say you're not an expert and you are representing like a charity that represents people with visual impairment. And maybe you're not even like an expert in policymaking. And then you find yourself in this very like formal environment and a member of parliament or somebody, some government official is like, what do you think about this? You know? So already that structure shows hierarchy and power. So there is, it's very evident there. And so you come in there. First of all, you feel privileged to be invited. You're like, I'm so privileged. I need to be careful what I say because I'm so privileged. I have to make sure that the people I represent are not perceived in a certain way. So you already have certain inhibitions in both internally and even in that environment. So what we are doing with this collective mosaic is we are creating a space where these issues of hierarchy and power play do not fit in. So everybody will be coming in this very open space. There'll be nothing like board meeting, formal seating. Everybody will be doing the same exercise. And none of the participants, whether it's the policymakers or the stakeholder groups, will have the opportunity to enact their power in that setting. So we will be the facilitators in that situation. We ask the questions. And the purpose of doing that is we want everyone to be open about how they feel about those issues they're going to be talking about. And when we, the idea is that we drive that conversation and making everybody feel that they are included. In terms of opening up the space and what that means for minority groups and all, we have picked specific partners to deliver that project that represent specific minoritized groups. So we have one partner that's going to be doing it's the university, but their partners are developing a policy for, I think, audiovisuals. So we picked like partners who represent certain minoritized groups. But what we want in the end with this particular, after this testing period, because what we are doing is going through this testing phase with Welcome, is we want this idea and we want this method to be adapted and adopted in any setting, and that anybody can pick up a mosaic and anybody can say what that represents for them. And it's not meant to be a process that requires a skill or any like specific unique knowledge. It's purely about just making sure that everybody who reflects the society in which you're trying to enact change is actually represented at the table. And that's it. Nothing else is required.
No. It's an interesting approach. I mean, I was going to ask, you kind of answered it, I guess, but I guess there's the process of getting people around the table still, so to speak. So I can see what an interesting exercise it will be once you get the people around the table. But I suppose there's still a decision to be made around who's invited around that table, isn't there? And I don't know, I guess no policy making process is ever perfect, but can people self select to come? Can they see it advertised somewhere and then choose to come along? Or is it being invited only, as you were sort of alluding to earlier with the older structures?
So for this particular Welcome project, it's a testing project, let me call it that. So because of that, it has unfortunately to be a bit controlled. And I know there's argument for, you know, okay, you could still put other different parameters for that control, you know, but you could say that, isn't it? You could say like, okay, just open it up to anybody, and then you put the control parameters in another thing other than in participation. And I appreciate that. But what we've done specifically for this is that we have picked specific, like two partners or three partners to be specific, who were already working on an issue, a policy issue that's related to society.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
yeah.
One partner's working on indoor air quality, which I think everybody currently, if you don't know anything about the current problems in the UK housing sector and what that has had impact on society with the death of, I think it was our 2-year-old child, everybody knows, should know that at least to some extent. So they are doing that. And then we have another group that's doing something around people with impairments. And then there's another group doing, again, another policy issue. So they already have some specific policy questions or issues they were already working on. And what we just want to see is, can you actually apply this method in policy engagement?
Yeah.
What I'd like to see, Lachlan, though, is that in the future, it becomes a tool which can be applied in whatever setting. And that's why we've been testing it as well with the science engagement work. Because in science engagement, it's not about invitation, isn't it? It's about anybody who's able to come to those events then gets that to say. So it would be nice to test it in that way. But we are thinking about many ways. We are thinking about it as well, maybe in the future as a training tool as well for internal staff development activities. But these are just random ideas, not concrete ideas. Yeah.
No,
it'll be fascinating to see how it goes. Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah. No, and I was just thinking, first of all, the first thing was, I liked how you said when you pick up a piece, that it's a method that opens for where the point of departure for the discussion can be feelings. because when you pick up that stone, it doesn't have to be a prior knowledge on the topic, and how feelings here becomes a legitimate conversation opener on discussing the topic. I like that. And I get the point where you can say you should have completely open, and I understand why you have decided in a test that you limit who's there, because you have to control it and develop some data around it as well. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I think but it also speaks in as to one of what I think my new pet projects is to talk more about diversity literacy. Because at the end of the day, I think in most contexts, you simply can't have everybody at the table. Everybody can't be, the representation mm-hmm. can't be big enough, always at least. In some specific fields, perhaps, or in some discussions, perhaps. But generally speaking, at some point, I think it becomes about developing enough literacy to have people being able to represent each other. Perhaps not in a policy context, I don't know, but at least I think it's something that I'm at least more and more aware of, because of course representation matters, but we can't have everybody at the table at all times.
I think that's really a good point, because it's one myself which I am constantly thinking about, like what amount of representation is good representation.
Yeah.
And the way I see it is that anybody who feels that this thing, whatever it is, impacts them in one way or another,
sure.
has a right to be represented.
Yeah.
And that's always, like, this is my starting point of things. So
exactly.
If this issue impacts you in any way, you have a right to be represented mm-hmm. in that conversation. And sometimes it might even be impacting you and you don't know it yourself. So it's the responsibility of the person in authority
yeah.
who clearly should question, like, who is impacted by this issue, and then need to extend that invitation and inclusion in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I think it's...
But I don't know if this is the best way, but yeah.
No, but we're trying things out here. And I think the UK is probably the best place, because between REF and... But no, particularly because of REF, I think the whole idea of impact is advanced in a different way, and also the discussions on research culture that we can always talk about. You talked about the funding. The recent call on funding for research culture from Wellcome Trust. I was actually on the assessment committee there, I saw a lot of things there. But I think it can be tested a lot better in the UK, because you have some more detailed discussions, particularly when it comes to both EDI and impact. I think at European funders, it's often you have to decode it a bit. It's not as explicit as, and the vocabulary isn't as developed. It's not the same everywhere. And because of cultural differences in different, if you look at European funding, it also becomes a bit politicized as well, despite what people perhaps want it to be. And that makes it, I think it becomes slightly more difficult to navigate in some cases. So at least I think the UK is a good testing site for these things.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing I've learned as well, because obviously, like I mentioned in the beginning, so I came from Finland and then started to live here. So I've only been in the UK for 5 years, to be honest, not even that long. So when I think about the kinds of conversations I used to have in Finland around equality or diversity, didn't even call it that. The conversations were more about racism. And when we talked about equality, it was very gender focused. That's pretty much what it was. And then every time we talked about racism, it was related to immigration. So those are the two things. And I always found myself at the center of it all in that way, because I was like, okay, I'm a woman and I'm a black woman and I'm an immigrant. So I ticked all the boxes for the kind of people who shouldn't be in that country.
Yeah.
Or who shouldn't have a space. Maybe let me not be in that country, but have a space in anything.
Yeah.
If you think about it. But But the one thing I have found myself contending with since I moved to the UK was, first of all, I was so surprised at how robust the conversations on racism or EDI are here. And obviously now talking to people like natives or people from the UK, they'll tell me, no, we are not even doing a quarter of what we should be doing. But when I moved, I was like, wow, there is so much. There is so much work going on around this. But the one thing I've myself been contending with is that I had no idea until I got here how much internalized racism I had.
No.
And then that realization has also had an impact on me because I find myself processing it all the time. And I'm on this learning journey. But the thing I struggle with is that just because I'm a person of color, I'm not an EDI expert, which is very easy to misconstrue, isn't it? You know, just because you are, you know, you sort of fit into the box of a certain minority doesn't make you an expert on that around EDI. And this is one of the things I keep sort of coming up against. And I cannot begin to tell you how scared I am sometimes to post things related to EDI on my LinkedIn because of all the keyboard warriors out there. You know, I don't want to write anything that's going to come and bite me back later.
No, exactly.
So I'm in this journey where I'm very much like, as I've mentioned many times, this is something I'm very passionate about. It's something I want to drive. But I'm also conscious that I do not want to sell myself as an expert around EDI because I'm on my own learning journey. I'm still processing my own internalized racism issues. And I'm very careful to put myself out there.
Yeah, but I also think it's an area where the more you learn, the more you realize you need to learn more, and the more cautious you are to claim yourself an expert, because you just realize how the complexity of the issue is like boundless.
Exactly.
But also, I think I understand why. Sometimes I think we don't necessarily have to claim yourself an expert, but just knowing something that can help people take the first step. The problem is also, I think, often that we want to, as we talked about earlier, we want to solve it all, and we can't. Nobody can. It's a complex issue, but we all try to take some steps to make it better, and then we learn something, and we can take a few more steps to make it even better from there as well. Anyway,
exactly. The one thing I've come to value is the lived experience. Oh, sorry, I went on without.
No.
Sorry, I was saying that.
Exactly, and I think there is. Go on.
No, I was going to say the one thing I've come to value is the lived experience of people, you know, and how that can contribute to, you know, you don't have to be an expert, but you have that lived experience. And that already means that you have something that is very important and which can contribute to conversations and to changing this area.
Yeah. And also because people have a lot of ideas about how things are that can be very distant from the lived experience. I definitely have some conversations with people about what it's like to be gay sometimes. It's like, oh, honey, you have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. The lived experiences should be valued. Anyway, we want to be a bit careful of your time. I think we could just continue discussing for another hour without any problems here. But as I have for a last question is, we are both researchers and research managers as listeners here, and you, of course, work with both groups. If you should give each group just one or two pieces of advice based on our conversation, what would that be?
So for maybe I could position this in the context of something I'm currently doing. So based on the work I've been doing for quite a bit around international research and specifically international research collaboration between high-income countries and low- and middle-income countries, I've been working on developing content and information around equitability mm-hmm. in that context. And what I have found to be quite interesting is how different challenges at that level are also very visible, even at a local level. So the content which I've been developing is very much rooted around power dynamics. What does power mean for a high income country that's working with a low middle income country in research, and how that power then affects or impacts how equitable their research collaboration is? And I've been reflecting on that also in the context of local research. So say a university wanting to do research on a topic that could impact a specific area in society or a specific geographical location, and how power plays in those relationships.
Yeah.
And what I've concluded generally is, if you are a researcher, you need to start from a point of positionality
mm-hmm.
and to think that, okay, yes, I'm an academic, and definitely your priorities are, you might be wanting to produce a very good paper at the end of this, but you need to reflect about what you are doing from that position of power and having that positionality of you mm-hmm. as an academic, and then of you as a representative of the organization that you're working with. And the other thing, though, is that this journey of being a bit more open in research and innovation or inclusive is not one that can be sorted or addressed by doing one specific activity or intervention. It's a long-term change, because we've not gotten where we are at in 1 year or something. It's been decades of rhetoric, different mindsets and all. So it's a journey. And I think academics shouldn't feel, because as academics, you want to prove things, and you don't want to do something that's sort of vague, but they shouldn't feel fear about doing this, because they think that, oh, maybe I'm not able, or I'm not an expert in this, I cannot actually be part of this change. Because you can be part of that change. You don't need to be an expert in that. You just need to be wanting to do that kind of change. I'm very passionate about research managers, because I worked for 3 years at ARMA, the Association for Research Managers and Administrators. And what I completely appreciated at the end of those 3 years is the role that research managers play in also driving change and enabling academics to translate these complex discussions and these complex situations. And I think that role should be more highlighted, and that role should mm-hmm. be more supported. So I think research managers in institutions should stop being viewed as just administrative support who are running these processes, but they should actually be valued as change makers in the context of all these other conversations around EDI, research culture, responsible research.
Mm.
They should be centered as well as change makers.
Yeah. Very good. Both having worked as research managers in our previous lives and in my current life as well, and of course, I very much appreciate that and agree with that. Anyway, we want to be respectful of your time. Thank you so much for joining us here today and having this conversation. We will look forward to both follow you and work with you and particularly see what comes out of the mosaic making process and how that can hopefully change things as a process. And that was our chat with Ava. So Lachlan, what were any takeaway points from our discussion?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is, I just wonder if we're starting to see a shift in terms of the sort of ethics and values that drive the work in this area. So, I mean, we've been banging on about it for a long time, haven't we? So this is not going to come as a surprise to anyone. But I don't think we've really met too many other people or businesses who underpin their work with an ethos around fighting for fairness and social justice, making sure they take into account ethics in what they do. So that was really, it was unusual, but refreshing to hear Eva talk about that and talk about what their company is trying to do and what that kind of means when they interact with higher education institutions or researchers, who I think also are starting to slowly but surely come around to understanding that research is not done in a vacuum. You know, you do have to have values. No matter what your research is, actually. And she did talk a little bit about the, I guess, challenges of working within, say, STEM subjects against social science subjects. But either way, there are values which underpin what you do and how you operate as a team and how you operate as an institution. And I thought that was,
exactly.
Well, that was just a really refreshing start. Let's put it that way, in terms of the conversation and where this is going.
Yeah. And we should perhaps clarify that by other consultancies or universities, et cetera, not being, we're not saying that they're not ethical just because they don't say it. They probably are, but I think we're probably at a point where we just, it's just refreshing that someone is explicit about it. And we would like to see more people about that, because other way, it's sometimes, if you're not, it allows people to sometimes get away with murder. In this field, at least. And that was quite refreshing that they were willing to put it out there and set some standard that they are willing to discuss if they meet and have it in as a core part of their product. That would be good to see more, not only consultancies, but universities more broadly and the sector more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, they are very explicit about it, aren't they, in terms of their website and their communications and things like that. No, I was just saying they are very explicit about it in terms of, it's not just they talk about it, but it's on their website and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. And you can also, in the discussion about the mosaics, you can hear how that was a core part of that as well. I will, however, say that when we talked about it and it was like how it was part of their product communications, science communication, et cetera, I do believe that that was, she said that they were very clear that this wasn't about politics. And I get that. I just think we're a bit beyond that point, particularly in some areas of this, when particularly if we're talking race, ethnic minorities, gender and sexual orientation. I think it becomes increasingly difficult to insist on it not being political in any way. Mm. And I think it's, if we continue to do that, it's that insistence that research happens in a vacuum. And I'm not sure that we can both insist on that and insist on having societal impact.
No, I think that's right. I mean,
sometimes you have to get your fingers dirty in this game. And I think they do. I'm creating a bit of a straw man here. I think, but it's just because it speaks to some of the things that we often hear, when doing work in the sector. So I think that would be my only certain really area of concern. That being said, I think it was really interesting to hear her journey as well, and how it confirms one of the things that we often talk about, that when we talk about diversity, it is so country specific. How the discussion in Finland was very different from the one in the UK. And it just differs because of politics, of history, of culture, so many things influences it. And when we, if we don't take that into account, we're not even sure that we're discussing the same thing. And also how she experiences it, the debate as a Black woman differs, of course, a lot from being in Finland, where she was probably the only one. I've often talked that I was probably born in one of the whitest countries, one of the few countries that could probably compete is probably Finland. So in that sense, of course, moving to the UK is very different, and discussion about race is very different. And it would be. And it's just so important to take into account when we are having these discussions globally, as we often are in research projects and in research management, when to make sure, and that's why we need these discussions, because we're not talking about the same thing.
No, we're not. And I think that she was talking about that, she was highlighting absolutely how cultural intelligence and understanding cultures is so fundamental and so contextual. And it's something that we often talk about in our work. Her journey was actually a really fascinating example of moving from culture to culture and the environment and how that impacts on the discussions you have and your day-to-day work and inclusion and equity.
Yeah, exactly. And we're of course biased because it confirms everything we're talking about, but it was just good to hear that how that's actually true. Before we end this episode, just go to the Mosaics and the Wellcome Trust funding, which I found really interesting and a great approach to it, and very non-traditional, but that's the whole point of the funding. So in that sense, that of course makes sense. Do you have any thoughts about it?
Only that it kind of blew my mind a bit, to be honest. It's so sort of out there. So I think it's going to be quite hard for some people to conceptualize what that might look like. But that again is kind of the point of the grant, is to test this out. Is this a way of engaging with communities around public policy and things like that, which could be better or more successful or whatever it might be than, sending out a consultation form or whatever it might be. So as we said to her, it'll be interesting to follow that project, because they really are right at the beginning, aren't they? It'll be interesting to follow that project and see what comes of it, because there will be some lessons in there. There will be some interesting lessons, I'm sure.
There will. As I said in the interview, how it allows for feelings to be the point of departure for the discussion. And you can always get into the rationale, but by picking a piece, and you have to say, why did that piece speak to me? And based on that, that way of leveling the playing field in a way, and you can get people with a very different background in, and you will basically be speaking, at least the point of the departure will be the same. And then, of course, there'll be all kinds of structural things there and powers and stuff like that, depending on who's there. But at least it's a different approach, and we're really looking forward to see where that takes us. So hopefully we'll have it either on another time, and we can see what happens. All right. I think that was it for today. So we will be back in a couple of weeks, and then we will
have
another interview, and we will see what's then. See you soon.